afternoon. I am Raymond C. Ferguson. I'm doing an interview of Professor Paul Doty in his office at Harvard, the biochemistry department. Paul, we first want to start with your father's occupation. What did he do?
Yes, he was in the oil business, and first in West Virginia, and then in Western Pennsylvania, where we moved when I was about seven. He was early in his career had been the telegraph operator in our town, and then worked in the oil business and managed an office which collated the production of a lot of small companies in Western Pennsylvania. We were relatively poor, and the depression hit us rather hard, so I started to operate on a small budget early on.
This was what was the town in Western Pennsylvania?
It was called Chicora, C-H-I-C-O-R-A. It was about 50 miles north of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. And your mother, what was your mother's background?
She had neither of them had any higher education. She came from that part of Pennsylvania. She was a Scottish English background. My father's background was, I think, half English, half German. And I grew up from seven till I went to college in this town of about 1,000 people, and I was the only child, and had quite a bit of time to myself, in as much as there wasn't many competitions like television and so forth. I guess my father bought me a chemistry set after Christmas when I was nine. It was marked down because it had been frozen and somewhat inoperative, but that certainly got me going. And I had a little laboratory in an outhouse near our home, and did a lot of grass cutting to buy chemicals for it, and that was quite a major preoccupation. When it came to high school, the chemistry teacher was the basketball coach and somewhat more interested in basketball, and so after a while he let me teach the class, and that was a great lift. And I remember so well that in 1934, when I was 14, there were two events in Pittsburgh. One was the dedication of the Mellon Institute, and the other was the meeting of the American Chemical Society. And I saved up my money and went to both, and I was very inspired, particularly the speech at the Mellon Institute. I remember Harold Urey spoke and others, and I really ate that up. The meeting of the American Chemical Society was more differentiated. Jack Kirkwood got the American Chemical Society Award in Pure Chemistry there, and I had a great awe of theoretical matters, but no understanding. So I followed him about. I thought he was a great role model until I saw him go into the bar and have a drink. That was the first year after Prohibition, and I was brought up very strictly, and I thought this was certainly inconsistent. And but then I listened to papers and so forth, and then came the presidential address at the end, and I didn't have money for that, so I sat on the balcony while everyone ate their chicken and awaited the presidential address, which followed the dinner. And it was by a man whose name I think was Barton, old Professor Barton from Iowa. and he spoke on 50 years of sewage disposal, which rather took the edge off my keen anticipations. But I tell that only because it comes up later, in that I guess when I was 34 or so, I got the same prize and went to Dallas, meeting the American Chemical Society, to receive it, and saw somewhat late in the day that I was to speak at the dinner that evening where it was being awarded. So I thought I would embellish the story of my first meeting, and so the dinner progressed, and I get up to speak, and I just got launched when I looked down and saw on the nearby table an old man who I recognized as Professor Barlow. So I had to backtrack altogether. I couldn't tell the story, or the whole structure of my speech was gone. So I gave a very poor speech, but I was glad I'd seen him, because I saw on CNN News that he died a month or two later, and I felt that I would be so guilty if I had made a joke about him in his last days.
Well, what books did you read in high school that prompted you, or that helped you teach chemistry?
Well, I was quite a reader, although I'm dyslexic and a slow reader. I read a great deal, and I think The Life of Pasteur, for example, by Valerie Rodot, was very influential. The Life of Madame Curie, and I think it was a four-volume series on the science of life or something, and
you were starting to say Eddington or something.
Yeah,
like
Eddington had a book in those days that I read.
Yeah. Was Paul de Kruijff's book out that early?
I don't think so.
No. He was late.
He hasn't gotten that far west. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
Was there a laboratory manual or teaching manual?
I got an old one from a college in Grove City on qualitative analysis and worked my way through that, I remember. And there was a chemist at a small petroleum products company a few miles away, and I did get visited with him some. But what stands out mostly are these visits to Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. So you would have had how many in your graduating class from high school then?
There were 22. It was the largest that had ever graduated. This was a wooden schoolhouse with a coal stove in each room. And
okay, you.
So that was I did quite well in school. Languages were difficult because my dyslexia, but I did quite well, and did chemistry, physics, biology, and general science, all four courses, which is not often the case today.
You mean in high school?
Yeah.
Oh, that's unusual. Why Pennsylvania State College then?
So that was what the advice I generally got, that my parents would have liked to have kept me closer to home, but they were rather agreeable to my ideas. That was what also made my upbringing a little was beneficial, I think. They did give me leave to do as I wanted if I thought it too hard enough. So I went to Penn State, and that was a new world. And Frank Whitmore was dean of chemistry and physics then, and he was his personality projected throughout the School of Chemistry and Physics in a big way, and that was very influential. I remember he gave a 1 hour a week course to everyone who was enrolled in chemistry or physics or chemical engineering, and it was really good. It was dynamic and forward-looking, and had lots of moral philosophy You know, there's no such thing as a dishonest chemist. So I ate that up. That was very good. And then I had the good luck to become acquainted with John G. Aston, Jack Aston. I presume he's now dead, although I haven't seen it. But he was a transplanted Englishman who had the cryogenics laboratory at Penn State and did heat capacities on various molecules, measuring the barriers to internal rotation and so forth. And he took a liking to me, and I took his courses, and even though they were in graduate school, and that was very good. I did a lot of work both for pay and my senior thesis there, and I think that I think my first publication was when I was 19 from there on the rotational barriers and methylamine.
Right. In fact, I looked at that paper, and this is heat capacity and entropy spectroscopic data alone. Sounded like you were getting the Bright Wilson field.
Yes, that's a little bit. Yes, that's right.
Aston's interest? Or
no, this was Aston. Yes. Yes.
Was this the title of your senior thesis? Or
yes, that and the yes, that's right.
An early paper.
Yeah, that was a very, very positive.
Did you take a straight chemistry curriculum?
I was a straight chemistry. There wasn't biochemistry in those days. There was a lot of urine analysis, and so I didn't come close to that. In fact, I never had a course in biochemistry, and I stayed summers. I worked two or three summers at Penn State, and so that was great.
How did you support yourself?
Well, I did odd jobs and waited in tables quite a bit. I lived at the Alpha Chi Sigma, the chemistry fraternity, and that was good for me too, because I needed some socializing, and that was certainly supportive in chemistry as well. So that was positive. And all in all, it was quite good. I stuttered a great deal when I was young, and the speech clinic there got me more or less straightened out on that. I took a course in public speaking one summer school, I remember. So that was all to the good. And then I took a fair amount of physics. I took optics, I remember, from Dr. Rank, and differential equations and vector analysis and so forth. So
Dr. Rank, that rings a bell with me. I can't.
Yes, I.
Was it Arthur Rank, or am I thinking of someone else?
I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But the physics courses I like very much. That's very good for me.
Did you have minors? Was there?
I don't think there were minors then.
Mm-hmm. How about math? Did you?
I think so. I remember the differential equations, the partial differential equations, vector analysis. That kept me moving.
Can you remember any particular texts that were used? Or?
Not very well, I think. Mm-hmm.
How large was your chemistry graduating class?
I would guess it was about, it was fairly good size. I guess it was 80 or 90. I was, I think, president of the student council in the School of Chemistry and Physics, but I don't recall it being a very demanding job. And so then I went off to Columbia. I remember, I was somewhat precocious, so I remember in the summer of 1939 I came to visit. This was between my summer 39. Well, I guess it must have been the summer. No, it was the summer 39. The summer of 40. So before my senior year, I made the rounds. I visited Princeton and had a visit with Irving, and came up here and had a visit with Kistikowski. and went to Columbia and had a visit with Yuri, which is, I don't know if I'm just the same ease of access these days to comparable people, but Aston wrote ahead for me, of course, that helped, and I remember visiting Percy Bridgman over here in the physics.
Oh, yeah.
He had nailed his charter on the wall of not allowing anyone from Nazi countries to visit his laboratory, and I really came away with the feeling that the war was really on after that trip, because it didn't quite seem that way back in Pennsylvania.
From Bridgman or from other people?
From Bridgman, well. Fistikowski was already talking about going off to the explosive laboratory in Pittsburgh, and Yuri didn't think he would be there by the time I arrived, and so on.
Okay.
So I got offers from all of them, and they were all attractive, but I went to Columbia, I guess on the theory that there were more people there, and therefore there might be some left after whatever the war did. But that was also a good experience, because I had the most remarkable set of people in that first fall term of 41 before the war really, the Manhattan Project really took over. I had Yuri and Fermi and I sat in on Robbie's lectures.
And Joseph Meyer.
And Joe Meyer, yes. And Lemaire, he taught thermodynamics. And Teller, Edward Teller, theoretical physics. So that was quite a exciting.
Sounds like you were taking more physics than chemistry.
Yes, it does. I think I was. I think chemical physics wasn't defined as a subject area yet, a concentration area. That's what I was sort of doing. Yes, and I was not good in organic chemistry. My only C grade in college was in organic analysis, I think, where I a combination of phenol and whatever it was that turned into bakelite every time I heated it.
Phenol formaldehyde.
Yes, yes.
The reaction.
Yes.
Supposed to be an easy reaction.
Yes.
Not really that book.
Yeah.
It is, in fact, a little bit touchy.
I see. Yes. But I think partly also my memory was not all that good in organic chemistry, so that sort of pushed me off in the physical side too.
What was Teller teaching? Spectroscopy?
No, it was theoretical physics, and he was quite a good teacher. And I can remember the first day. He started off. We have to begin with the vector. What is a vector? So I was in the front row and held up my hand and gave the usual definition of scalar length and direction. And he said, "How do you tell that from a chimney?" You know, and I was felt put down pretty badly. And he was a good teacher. And Fermi was terrific.
Was Fermi's English good?
Yes, his English was pretty good, and he taught thermodynamics also. I guess maybe I only said it in his lectures, but they were very good.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great man. Yeah.
And so then did Yuri leave?
So they began to disperse. They set up laboratories there at Columbia, and I guess by the spring term I was working part-time on the Manhattan Project, mostly on heavy water work, which didn't come to anything in particular, but I got good laboratory experience. And I think by the second year most people had left, and there wasn't much more to do in form of courses. So I did this thesis with Joe Meyer, and he was a theoretician and did not pretend to help much in the laboratory part. But Zim and Bill McMillan and I were together. And
was Zim at Columbia?
Yes, we were in the same class, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I got to know him first off because Lemaire seated everyone alphabetically, and I came in a little bit late, so I got put at the end of the row beside Zim. So that's how that started. Then we eventually married sisters. I later became divorced, but he didn't. So we had a long period there.
These were girls you met at Columbia?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the thesis itself was on electron emissions and some bond energy that one could calculate from it. I enjoyed the apparatus and vacuum tube work and so forth.
These are the papers, a series of papers on the hot wire,
yes,
the hot filament.
That's right.
Experiments.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing revolutionary, but a good practice. And also very modest requirements. I just think I bound the three papers together for my thesis of 14 pages, and that was it. And but then somehow I got to know Hermann Mark about 43 or 44, and I suppose Peter Debye came along to lecture either.
Were you still working on the Manhattan Project?
I think that was fading because it was moving all to Chicago and elsewhere, and I think that probably phased out. And
okay, then
I can't remember how I first made contact with Herman, but I fear it must have been I went to lecture Devise over at Brooklyn Poly. So by late 43, the Life Scattering came along, and Jim and I got interested in that, and he built a little apparatus on the side up at Columbia, and I got my degree in 44, didn't I? So I think I'd moved to Brooklyn by then.
At this point, were you involved with the rubber project?
That came later, but I did get to know Mark and started going over there on Saturday. They had very good Saturday seminars.
I've heard various versions from various persons. Bert Nichols was telling me quite a bit about the early light scattering work.
Mm-hmm.
This originated with Debye, actually.
Yes.
His idea of the light scattering from solutions.
Yes, I think that he deserves the major the credit for recognizing that there was a quantitative tool there.
Did he build an apparatus, or did they build an apparatus at Columbia, or was yours the first?
I think ours was the first around there. A man who had a long career in polymers, Bill Maher, I think, was at Cornell and built an apparatus there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so I think the experimental work went along about in parallel. And
so your first papers with them came out of the work at Columbia, did they?
Yeah, I think that they came out of the gadgets we built at Columbia. And then I guess I must have moved lock, stock, and barrel in 44 over there, and I think I must have started working on that quartermaster project. And that
I think your papers indicated somewhat how you verified the molecular weights and compared the molecular weights by light scattering with the molecular weights as measured otherwise.
Yes, osmotic pressure and so forth, but of course they measured different averages, and therefore it was a little sloppy.
Did you recognize that at the time?
It was pretty loose, and of course throughout all of its history, the biasing effect of dirt in your solution was pretty serious, and you went to great lengths to get rid of that.
Nichols claimed that he sent some molecular weight standards that he had characterized by
ultrasensitive
for you to work with, or somebody to work with.
Did you get to look at those? I think those were part of Stein's thesis, yes, number 14.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think those are his. And Stein is the head of the polymer group out at the Amherst.
Yes, I know Stein well.
I think of him as my first student.
Uh-huh. I was going to ask you.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. No, he was a very bright young fellow, and it was his senior thesis, actually. I think that was the first.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
And did he stay on for graduate work?
I think he did, yes.
Brooklyn? Uh-huh. So you may have moved immediately into the faculty or instructor.
Yes, I was an instructor, I think, and I think that, as I recall, I taught 9 hours a week, which is something I haven't done since. But I had three courses that met three times a week in the evening. That was really stressed me.
Did Jim go to Brooklyn with you, Brooklyn Poly with you, or did he?
Yes, he was there for a little while, and I don't know quite.
That's I'm really asking you to tell
yes.
other people's stories, but
yes, I'm a little vague on that, mm-hmm. but I think he was certainly there for a while. Yes,
he got the Zimplot named after
that's
him.
That's right. Yes.
But I think you together made an important contribution in the analysis of sex of college diversity.
Yes,
that
I think we pulled that out of it, mm-hmm. and that was useful.
Did you sense how important this was, or did it seem important to you at the time?
Oh yes, I think it did seem fresh and new, and we weren't perhaps very self-critical in those days. So it all went wonderfully fast, and Altry was there. Altry was a great supporter,
yes.
And I did have a paper or two with him, as I recall.
Well, in fact, those were impressive papers. Specifying the properties of viscoelastic material.
Oh, yes, yes. He was very good. I learned a lot doing that
paper. Was he a graduate student working for you? Or no?
I think he was a year or two older, and therefore he was a little older, yes. So he must have also been instructor or maybe assistant mm-hmm. professor, yes.
Well, you had, I think you had two notable papers there. That one was the viscoelastic materials.
Yes.
Statistical thermodynamics of high polymer solutions was the earlier paper.
Yes, and we meant to follow that up in the series and never did. Yes, that's
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm. How about your involvement in the polymer liquid interaction by swelling measurements? Connected with your general wartime research? Or?
No, I think that was on the side. I think probably a little bit of it came from the film work, but mostly we were measuring diffusion constants and transmission rates. And film was aimed at polyethylene socks and so forth for people in the trenches and so on, and rain protection.
You were associated with a Quartermaster Corps project.
Yeah, that was on polymer films, yes.
Were you particularly associated with the rubber project?
No, I wasn't. No, that was more organic chemistry, yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And
So
many of these things were on the side.
I think you had some official title in, with respect to the Quartermaster Corps project, didn't you?
I might have been co-director with the Army fellow.
I saw that somewhere.
Yes, I think that's so.
Okay, fine. But then you didn't stay long at Brooklyn, though.
I guess I wanted to get out and see more of the world, for one thing, having not been in the war itself, and
how did you become a Rockefeller fellow at Cambridge then?
Yes, well, I suppose Van Kuiken, who was in Mark's group and had been in Cambridge and London a lot, excited me by his tale. He was a very good raconteur of the pre-war X-ray business, and then somehow through him and Mark I got introduced to Mr. Pomeroff, who was Van der Rock Fellowship sitting there. So I had a good interview with him, and got the fellowship awarded for in the spring of 46. And I decided I'd take my chances and resign from Pauli and hope to find a job when I came back. And then two or three weeks before I was to leave, I found in the fine print that the fellowship was contingent upon having an academic job to come back to. So I guess the first person I fell upon after that was Charlie Price, who was going to Notre Dame. And so he offered me a job, and I took it there.
Oh, was he going as a
chairman of the department? Yes, I think so, yes. Yes.
That's right, he had been at Illinois.
That's right, yes. So that was fortunate, and so I went off to England.
Let's pause here. I'm almost at the end of the tape. Yeah, I think a funny little trick of pausing and stopping until you speak. Now you can continue with your experience at Cambridge.
Well, before we go there, I think I should go back to Brooklyn and say that the liveliness of that scene, which came mostly from Mark and Pantusen, was pretty remarkable. And getting to know people like DeBye and Florey and Bill Baker and so forth, that accelerated my career and my whole sense of professionalism enormously. And that was a very important part of it.
So the, Bill Baker was at...
he came to these Saturday seminars. It was a, it was a really a great gathering.
Okay, Burt Nichols mentioned those Saturday seminars. He used to come up for moments and thought they were outstanding.
Yes.
They must have been to be worth a trip for a moment.
Yes, in those days, yes.
Yes.
And well, I'm sure that a lot of others, but DeBye and Florey and Bill Baker stand out, I think, and the DuPont people. And
First, New York and Brooklyn are very strategically located for people coming in and out. And
Oh, yes,
I suppose you had
other things.
Did you have a lot of people drop in at Columbia just on their way through?
Yes.
Seems to me going to England in 1946 was wouldn't have been my ideal choice.
No, I was not very sybaritic then, I don't think, and but it was pretty hard. In fact, 46 was their worst winter. The coal ran out. Rivers overflowed, and the electricity was on only on a few hours a day. And I still remember the headlines in the paper in Cambridge when they raised the amount of meat and sausages from 5% to 10%. So it was better to go through that one in Houston later on.
Was it? I suppose there was nothing comparable to that, even with World War shortages in Brooklyn.
No.
You were comfortable, no problem?
Yeah, you had the ration cards, but there was not much, not much meat, but it was pretty good compared to England.
Well, what did you work on?
Well, in England, I was Cambridge, too, was just coming back together after the war, and Mark's friend there was Eric Riedel, R-I-D-E-A-L, and he came back as professor of colloid science, and that wasn't quite my cup of tea, but I didn't have any other contacts, nor was there much going on either. And he had a younger collaborator, Schulman, and so I worked some with him on surface balances and monolayers and so on. But it wasn't very interesting work. And but there were other people that I got to know, like Gordon Sutherland with the infrared.
Oh, yes.
And at that time, Woodward here was making the synthetic polypeptides, and I carried them back and forth, and that was quite intriguing, although we didn't have any publications.
You mean you made trips back and forth?
Yes, somehow I brought them together, yes. I took the samples when I went,
Mm-hmm.
And
Southern got the first spectra of polypeptide bonds in beta form and random form. And in fact, I named my son after him. And then Kenneth Bailey was there, a protein chemist. He later died, but he was a long talk with him. And then I guess most of all with Max Strutz. And he was already established working on hemoglobin, and I think he was probably the most influential person. As he has been ever since.
Was this where your interest in biopolymers and biochemistry?
Oh, yes. That really seemed to fell together, that having this book in poly work in synthetic polymers, that I should try to see to what extent the same principles apply to the more complex molecules.
Did it seem to you right away that the light scattering would be applicable?
Well, I guess I just thought I would give it a try. I was sort of back and forth between the X-ray work, which seemed promising, but which I didn't have much background in, and solution work, which I did have a background in. And so there came out of that the attempt to use synthetic analogs of proteins and nucleic acids and go at them in the way one had studied high polymers.
Well, you did a paper on light scattering studies of tobacco mosaic virus with Austria.
Oh, with Austria, yes, I forgot about that.
Was that after you got back, or was that earlier?
I think that was earlier, if I'm not mistaken.
The paper was dated 47, but...
Yeah, I think that was... It might have been work. I just can't remember. But Oster was in New York, and I was not at Notre Dame, and so I think that was sort of work that he carried on, and we wrote it up when I got back. I think that's probably the way it was.
Continue talking. I know I've got
yes.
a copy of that paper
yes.
here, but.
Well, I think that was a nice test of things, because that virus is long enough to have a first-order diffraction effect with visible light, so we could get its dimensions quite nicely. Yeah.
Yeah. There it is.
Yeah, that's it, yes.
Oster was at Rockefeller Institute?
I think he was then, yes.
Mm-hmm. And,
yes.
Okay, so that was a
good...
I wonder if that was the first paper on light scattering from biopolymers.
Yes, it might well be, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I think, again, just going over this scene in Cambridge, there was also Bill Asbury, who was at Leeds, but he came to Cambridge often. He was a, before the war, had the best X-ray fiber diagrams of both proteins and nucleic acids. And although they're very poor by present standards, you could begin to see that there's a very interesting order there. And he was a very lively fellow and wrote a lot of letters back and forth when he didn't come to visit.
Did your wife go over with you?
Yes, and she did some of the work with Schulman.
Well, she was a chemist?
But she was not, she had not been trained as a chemist, so she was a laboratory technician. Mm-hmm. So she went. And then, because it, there were so few American scientists around, I got invited to a number of places. I went to kind of just on Sweden, Fredburg, and Fadron in Strasbourg.
Okay. Yeah, now, continue about the your European contacts.
So I'd say the I remember best the trip to Sweden and the trip to France and Holland.
First, now, Swedberg had been doing ultracentrifuge work on some biopolymer.
That's right, yes. That was a very interesting contact, and he was old but still very lively. Cedron was a physicist who had turned to macromolecules and had a difficult wartime experience, but he was setting up shop in Strasbourg, and I visited there several times. And Ben Wall, one of his earliest collaborators, then came over and spent a couple of years here.
At Harvard?
At Harvard, after I got settled. Mm-hmm. And that was a good collaboration. And but I got to know Bernal and Joliot Curie and some of the polymer people in Holland, J.J. Herman and
Synthetic polymers,
yes,
as well,
yes,
as,
yes.
As well as,
yes,
the biological.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that was very good. And so then I came back the following summer. I think I stopped here to give a talk. And by that time, also in England, I went down and spent a couple of months in London at the Royal Institution, where Radil had moved, and built a light scattering apparatus there. And I guess I started to work on the dissociation of insulin as by light scattering. And I had enough to talk about when I came through here. I remember in September of 48. So I knew sooner got settled at Notre Dame than I got the offer here, practically, which was difficult because I didn't like to leave Notre Dame so quickly, and I didn't feel these kind of opportunities came along very often. So
I see.
So tread water for a year and came here.
Did you, were you able to do much at Notre Dame?
No, I really couldn't. There was no point in building anything.
Oh, I see.
So
I was just about to ask, were the light scattering apparatus at that time was all home built?
Yes, it still was,
built.
Yes. Yes.
There were no commercial.
No, I think about 1950 they became commercial, yes.
Yeah. So,
and,
Did you design yours, or did...
yes, it was all sort of self-designed, yes. And then I think the Phoenix Instrument Company built the first commercial ones, yes.
Was Father Francis Newland still alive, or there at Notre Dame?
Think not. Mm-hmm. No, I can't remember him.
Yeah.
But it was a good place, and it has shown to be since. There was this laboratory for germ-free life, which was going on there. I didn't understand much about it, but it was a very impressive assembly of techniques and so forth, and so there was a little biology there, too.
Did you teach there, or just...
Yes, I taught physical chemistry and polymer chemistry, mm-hmm. mostly physical chemistry, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you finally got to Harvard, what did you embark on?
So I got here at 48, and I had three graduate students straight off, and so we were able, by that time, you were able to prepare nucleic acid fairly well, and starting from thymus glands, which we got up at a local slaughterhouse in those days, and so we started out making as pure molecular weight, as pure samples as we could of nucleic acid. It was in the native double-stranded form, although we didn't quite know that then. But all of the samples then were degraded and therefore had a molecular weight distribution, not unlike polymers themselves. And so we didn't yet have the samples of identical molecular length from phages and so forth, viruses. So the girl Barbara Bunce did molecular weight measurements on that. That was a good start just to establish the molecular weight range of these
somewhat degraded samples was a step forward. And then there was a very bright fellow, Stuart Rice, who's now head of he's a professor at the University of Chicago and head of the one of the material sciences.
Biochemistry?
No, he stayed in chemistry.
Not Rice. Wrote a textbook in
his. Yes, that's right.
Stuart Rice.
Yeah,
he was
right.
Down in Texas and now at.
He's at Chicago.
I think he was at Texas at the time.
Yeah, maybe
he authored the book.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I know who you mean now.
Yes, he's a good fellow. Mm-hmm. Well, he was very inventive and got interested in the. In the denaturation of nucleic acid DNA, and did a lot of the very first work in his thesis on that. The fact is that because molecules are stiff and very long, it's quite viscous, but when you go above a critical temperature, they melt out and it becomes very non-viscous, and that sort of by viscosity and other high polymer techniques is very easy to follow.
I see. During this period, even spanning up to 50, you were still doing papers on synthetic polymers, though.
Yes, but I this was old work that I was bringing up to date. I didn't have anyone here.
Mm-hmm.
The third fellow worked on proteins, but that didn't lead to very much. That's how we got started, and then I think. For about 10 years, they were probably the most exciting 10 years. It was a matter of going after polypeptides as models of proteins, but synthetic polypeptides, and seeing if we could get those into helical form and solution with the Pauling alpha helix, and we succeeded in doing that. And once you have a ordered single helix, it again is very viscous, but when you go to a temperature beyond which it can sustain itself, it melts out very quickly and becomes much less viscous. And so we could do all of that with polypeptides.
Doing the transitions back and forth.
Yeah,
they were reversible.
Right, reversible, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very much like one dimensional melting. And then with DNA, we could do the same thing, and there was the two strands. And we worked very hard to try to show that the molecular weight fell in half when the molecule melted, because that would be consistent with the Watson-Crick theory of the two-stranded helix. And that was difficult to establish because the extrapolations of the Zim plot were a little imprecise, but I think we did establish that by 54 or so. And the woman who became my wife, Helga Botka, she was a graduate student then and did I got in study on gels, using gelatin and degraded collagen. So that was our attempt to explore gelatin and collagen, and it was an interesting a paper, but we wanted to get on to collagen itself because feeling that it was a three-stranded helix. And so by 56, when I gave this talk at the National Academy of Sciences, we had the parallelism between the helix coil transition for a single-stranded helix and the polypeptide, a double-stranded helix in DNA, and a triple-stranded helix in collagen. So that was in a sort of a nice unifying point of view and showed that phase-like transitions could occur in single, double, and triple-stranded biological molecules. So that was sort of the first phase of the work at Harvard, although other things were going on.
Let me back up to, the Harvard chemistry faculty being farsighted and hiring you, and were they thinking in terms of biochemistry?
I think they probably were. I think that they seemed quite interested in this little lecture I gave on insulin dissociation. And really, there was no biochemistry in those days except of what E.J. Coleman was doing over at the medical school on protein fractionation, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was no one who knew about the back mosaic virus or any kind of virus. It was really
I'm trying to think that we're talking about the late 40s. Okay, I had a faculty advisor at Iowa State. Nixon was his name. He became the dean of the School of Science.
Yes, I couldn't remember his name.
There was a guy named Fox there also.
That's right. Yes.
You knew him?
Yes.
I'm sure Nixon was more of a classical biochemist.
Yes, I think so.
He tried to persuade me to go into biochemistry.
I see.
I didn't want to do your analysis.
Yes. Well, and then I think the man who's now at the University of California in Santa Barbara,
biochemist?
Yes, from Iowa. He started out in Iowa and did light scattering and tobacco mosaic virus, I remember. Zinsheimer.
Okay.
He was at Ohio State, I guess. But he was a physicist.
It wasn't Iowa State at Ames. I think what you're saying, if I understand, is that at this point, the really fundamental physical studies of biopolymers in solution were just taking off.
Yes, and really, I think sort of got established by these configurational studies, because then they never thought about high polymers having this this endowment to take on these helical forms. But then along came the stereospecific polymerization work of Natta and others, and there you were. Although they, of course, didn't exist in solution, it was only in the crystalline form. And of course, that was sort of lucky for me too, because I got involved and I was consulting for Union Carbide. And going back to Charleston, West Virginia, where I'd been born. And so these came along at that time, and I was in a unique position to know a little bit about helical macromolecules.
Let's see, you got involved as an expert witness in
polypropylene. So that was.
Did you actually work with polypropylene?
I only talked about it and read the papers and so forth. Yes. And also, I'd also gotten into infrared work with Elkin Blout on the polypeptides, and indeed he made many that we studied. I had a fairly good understanding of the infrared side, and the X-ray side is fairly easy on that material. So I got into that, and I was on that 19 years. I guess it was the longest interference ever came down the pike.
It's going to continue.
And it isn't over.
It's being appealed.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's so much money there, it'll be fought on forever.
Yes, I suppose so, yes.
I don't know. It's a curious story. Interesting story, because the people involved in the politics.
I only knew a small fraction of it.
Yeah. Did you ever get any patents or of your own?
Can I
got to turn it on? You just mentioned consulting, so could we digress a little bit about who you've consulted for and what some of your experience has been?
I did do the carbide probably 6 or 7 years, and then the appearance case where I went to Chicago a fair amount for Standard Oil.
For your regular consultant with Standard? Or just on the...
area, just
I see. You're, I think, let's move that cord aside. There.
And,
went to Gillette a few times. Didn't they develop anything very permanent?
So this consulting was basically in Palmer,
yes,
Palmer Solution Properties, that sort of thing.
And then by 1955
and 56, they discovered the enzyme which can make synthetic polyribonucleic acids, ochoa. Got the Nobel Prize for that. And one of the people that worked with him, Fresco, came up here as a postdoc. And so we entered into the project of making synthetic synthetic polynucleotides. You're monitoring the tape when you...
I can hear it with this...
Uh-huh.
Try to keep track of what's coming across.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, then, having gone through the phase of
polypeptides, which I've mentioned, and we did a lot of optical rotation studies there that were very good. In fact, two papers from that period, one with Ernie's and one with Holsworth, have been... recorded by the Scientific Information Institute in Philadelphia is among the 250 most quoted papers, I think.
Holdsworth?
Yes. Holdsworth. Yes. And the one by Urey's, which was a review of protein chemistry.
I was looking at one of your articles. It was on the asymmetry and the optical rotary dispersion work. Is that part of
the same thing?
Optical
rotary dispersion. That's right. So we put a good slug on that, and that was good.
Did you introduce the use of the optical rotary dispersion measurement?
I think in terms of its application to proteins, yes. Mm-hmm. And,
was that with commercial equipment, or did you make your own?
It was commercial, but it was pretty modest. And the students in this 65th anniversary recalled how they went blind trying to use it.
Required direct
direct observation, matching hemispheres.
Well, wasn't there a recording optical rotary dispersion?
I think it came along not very much later, yes. So, yes, it's much better.
A few people had to do it the hard way.
That's right. And we did the polarized optical rotation and were able to get the, for example, the optical rotatory dispersion and the infrared spectra of the three configurations of the polypeptide chain, the random coil, the beta form, and the alpha helix. And so from that one could get a rough estimate of the extent of these three configurations in proteins, and that is quite helpful, particularly in selecting proteins for X-ray determination and so on. And Jochen Blauk, who's now professor at the medical school, was a good collaborator in this period. But then we went on to the polynucleotides in the middle and late 50s, and that went quite well, too. We could get DNA-like double-stranded helices out of them, and even triple-stranded helices. So that was a useful period, too. And during this time, my wife had shifted to study ribonucleic acids, and we were
the demonstrating for the first time the kind of localized structure that can develop by base pairing in single-stranded ribonucleic acids, and how one could use various denaturing agents and remove that localized structure and put all the physical chemistry of the ribonucleic acids in a very satisfactory form, and she was largely responsible for that.
Did Helga continue working when the children came along?
Yes, I think one time she took off 6 months, and the other time just a couple of those. So she was a good worker. We were benefited by having a house just 100 yards away, and I think that saved the situation in many ways.
Is the house gone now?
Oh, no, it's an old Cambridge fortress. It'll be there.
Oh, really?
Forever, I think. So,
pause.
Let's continue on this life, this work you were describing that your wife was working on.
Yes, she was continued then on the ribonucleic acid side, and she was really a pioneer in that, and no one knew quite what to make of those molecules in those days, partly because this local structure, it was not recognized that this local structure could be overcome by denaturing conditions which eliminated it but still did not degrade the molecule. And so in the late 50s then we came up to I guess our best work. It was the denaturation of DNA and its renaturation. And ever since Rice's work that I described earlier, we had the general idea that the strands would come apart under denaturing conditions in a rather phase-like melting out. But if so, they should go back together if they could find the right mesh, because it was not like the synthetic polymers where they could come back together anywhere, but it would have to be just in register with the original way it was originally laid down. And Julius Marmer came to the lab then as a postdoctor fellow, and he had worked with Hotchkiss at the Rockefeller Institute and had a good background in bacteria. So we concentrated mostly on bacterial DNA. And he made DNA from a number of different bacteria, and we found rather early on that some nice straightforward physical chemistry, there are two kinds of base pairing in the Watson-Crick model, guanidine cytosine GC and adenine thymine AT. And these DNAs from various bacteria covered a range of composition, so that we had a third of the percentage scale, from 30 to 60% of for example GC in different DNAs. So we had DNA molecules from different bacteria but with different relative amounts of these two base pairs.
And we quickly found that the melting temperature in standard saline solution was quite independent and linearly dependent upon the composition. So the more GC, the higher the melting temperature. So that was a nice clean cut breakthrough with lots of fallout over the next 10 or 20 years. And is it it gave the compositional consequence in terms of the physical property. Then we looked at it in the buoyant density in the ultracentrifuge and found a similar relation there. And indeed, we could put in DNA from a half a dozen different bacteria and band them in the ultracentrifuge, and they would come out in six bands located in the gradient of points corresponding to their differing densities. So that was a nice physical chemical side of it. And on the biological side, we just kept searching for means of bringing the, of restoring the double helical form. And we had the idea that it would be just like organic crystallization of organic molecules from the supernatant, that if you lower the temperature below the melting point, 25 degrees or so, it will, and give it time, it will nucleate and ultimately form crystals. And but it wasn't until we had the a bit of serendipity in that, the other physical matter which we exploited a great deal was that when the DNA denatures and comes apart, the stacking of the bases disappears and becomes randomized, and the intensity of the ultraviolet peak at 2600 angstroms falls about 30 or 35%, and therefore you can follow in the Beckmann spectrophotometer with very small samples the course of the denaturation and the renaturation if it occurs. And so we went through one of these melting curves one morning and went out to lunch and came back. The housing of the cell of the spectrometer had cooled, and we expected that it would nevertheless give the same high absorbance because it was denatured, but indeed it had come back down. And so we recognized that we had had a bit of luck, and renaturation was indeed taking place. And this is something we would not have discovered with more complex DNAs, because they're the because they have a much longer message in them, the probability at these concentrations of those finding each other again in solution is very rare. It might take a month or so for that to come back, so that it was lucky that we were having bacterial DNAs, which are rather simple, plus this technique, plus looking for it. And so we did find that these that renaturation occurred, and this was probably the best discovery we'd ever made. And again, I don't think I would have been primed to recognize it or begin searching for it without polymers, because without the background of sort of rubber elasticity, where you really believe in your heart that Brownian motion is going on all the time, do you have a mechanism for feeding out each other, never finding the points of registration? And I remember soon after discovering this, I gave a seminar at Caltech, and Max Delbruck was there. He was a great biophysicist, but no chemist. And he just claimed what I was showing them was absolutely impossible. The molecules would never find the points of registration, and get at the point where they could start generating orderly growth again. And we bet $20, which is quite a bit in those days, and Zinsheimer held the bet, I remember, and Delbruck didn't give in for another 5 or 6 years, but he finally did, and we gave it to the presidential candidate or something that year. So it was not an obvious idea for a person that had not did not understand rubber elasticity, I think, or how macrobrownian movement of macromolecules. So that was a nice synthesis of the past there, and that was really great. So then we were able to show that you could take, grow some bacteria in heavy nitrogen or deuterium and get the molecules labeled with a different density, and then melt, bring one unlabeled molecule from one source and a heavy labeled molecule from another, put them together, denature them, renature them, and see how much of a common hybrid was formed with the intermediate density, and that would tell you how much of the code from one was also common with the code for the other. And so we go through a whole lot of bacterial species, and now this has become a standard method of the taxonomy of determining the relatedness amongst species.
Now you're sure I'm clear, you're doing all this without doing any sequencing.
That's right, yeah, no sequencing. This was all before that.
Right.
But if the sequence was common to both, then they would renature under with a fairly standard rate, which we could predict them doing, seeing what the two things did independently. So we did a great deal of hybridization work then. And
now the the bacteriology, the part of this done here?
Yes. And of course, viruses have an even simpler code in them, and so they renature extremely rapidly. And the synthetic polynucleotides, which we had by then, that was so fast we could hardly get it. So that you have a whole spectrum from synthetic polynucleotides, which have, if it's all poly U on one side and poly A on the other, they just go together. There's no registration problem. Mm-hmm. Then viruses, then bacteria, and then on up into eukaryotic forms and up to humans, and it takes about a month for the human DNA to renature, and then it does it only in part. Well, this is, of course, gone into big business now, and much of it's sort of the first step in the DNA, we call it DNA work, that you can get renaturation and move things about this way, because they will only renature if they're in phase. So that was good, and then during the rest of the 60s, we exploited this, not as much as we should have, looking back on it, but it disseminated like all other good ideas, and many other people contributed. And it was only in the very early 60s that the idea that the code was read off the DNA onto RNA, ribonucleic acid, and that message went into the cell and produced the protein in a two-step operation that was emerging. And so we were able to show that ribonucleic acid freshly made in the cell could be hybridized with the DNA and therefore was indeed carrying the encoded message from the DNA into the RNA for the blueprinting of the protein synthesis. So that went along. We did some other interesting work in the late 60s, early 70s on very short synthetic polynucleotides with a designed sequence so that we could see how much the effect of one mismatch would, how much that would affect the melting point. And so there emerged the whole picture of how much defects cost in terms of stability of the two-stranded helix.
You have your own people here in the department who make these things for you?
No, we did all that ourselves in those days. And of course they weren't nearly as complex as you would make them now. Now they are made by technology.
Well, I mean, I've seen you take an incoming graduate student and put him in the lab and tell him to make this.
Yes, that was the way it was, yes. We had a little coaching. But one of the fellows who did best in this was Uhlenbeck. He was the son of the electron spin man. And he's now just moved from the University of Illinois to Colorado. He was very good and still is doing this sort of thing, very good. All in all, I think there are about five of these people are now members of the National Academy of Sciences. And I'm sure there's some more to come. So it was a very fruitful period. And
it doesn't seem consistent with your lack of enthusiasm for organic chemistry. Or
I see. Well, once it didn't involve too many complex reactions, it was helpful. And it goes on. Well, then I suppose in a sense, I suppose what propelled me into biological molecules from polymers was a feeling that one wanted to stay ahead of the game, that one wanted to apply what one knew to the more and more complex cases, hoping it would work. And then in the same sense, once one got the biological polymers sort of understood and organized into a framework, the next goal was sort of to go on to the synthesis of these molecules and see what one could do there with physical chemical attacks. So that there were two successive challenges there. One was to get on with the protein synthesis and see how the ribonucleic acid actually governed that synthesis and how the code was read out. And the other was to see if you could go beyond that to the next step and look at gene structure in higher organisms. So those are sort of the two last phases of our work. And on the protein synthesis side, we got in it a little bit too late to be in a terribly important role. Bob Thatch was a graduate student and became assistant professor here and did the best work. He's now at Washington University. And we did actually identify a couple of the elements of the genetic code for a couple of amino acids here, but we were 6 months or a year behind in that. Generally, and then by about 1970, we had to decide whether to how to go. I think the protein synthesis was becoming pretty well understood. The physical chemistry of biopolymers was pretty well understood. These are very qualitative judgments. There's lots of gold in the hills yet. The question was whether what to do, and we decided to go back to the structure of the genes and decided to pick on the collagen gene. A little bit sentimental because that was Helga had worked on back at her first postdoctoral job. I guess I didn't mention that, but after her thesis, which was 54, then her first postdoctoral job was on the structure of collagen in solution. And she did a great piece of work on that, getting the dimensions very nice and following the denaturation of this triple.
She stayed at Harvard for her postdoctoral and continuing.
Yeah.
Right.
She didn't stay. So that was under our belt. We had a certain attachment to collagen, I guess, from that time. And the collagen is a molecule sort of at the other end of the protein spectrum from simple enzymes, which have just one active spot and do one kind of catalysis. Collagen, again, going back to the polymer period, is the major structural protein of the body. About 30% of the protein in the body is collagen, nails, skin, blood vessels, and so on. So it's a versatile building material, and also if you go to the sort of ultimate stage of molecular biology, the molecular basis of growth and differentiation from the embryo on, collagen is the matrix in which all that takes place, so that although it won't be in our lifetime, we felt that the ultimate molecular biology of embryonic growth and growth all the way to maturation is largely a problem of reallocation of collagen molecules, and that one better get the basic things straight and how it is read out. I mean, the control, the synthesis and liberation of collagen at just the right time, and the fact that we have the same facial features from offspring, comparing to offspring, reflects a extremely finely controlled evolution of collagen to give the face the form that it has, and so forth. So this was sort of the inspiration of our last phase, which has gone on now for a dozen years or so, and And so we set to work, and more the work came jointly with Helga, and then more and more hers alone as I phased out on sorting out the collagen gene. And there are now about 10 collagen genes, but one of them can make about 90% of the collagen in the body, so that one tends to concentrate on that one first. And that turned out, we knew it would be a pretty long gene, because the protein is 100,000 molecular weight, so that was the minimum size. But as we got into it, the gene was larger and larger, and ultimately when we got it all figured out, it is about 12 times as long as the encoded message. An encoded message is broken up into 53 pieces, separated by large regions that do not carry any information. So it was certainly in its day, and not, and still almost, the most complex gene whose structure has been determined. We had now determined all of the encoding parts and more than half of the non-encoding parts. So that's enough.
You mean when you say determined?
By sequencing. So that
by the total sequence has been determined.
So we have, it's 39,000 bases long, and let's say about 25,000 of that is known, and that includes all of the regions that contain coded message.
Now, you got this information by...
This then became possible due to the revolution in recombinant DNA, that we could cut the gene at known places and analyze small parts of it and put it back on the map.
But you're not having to approach anything like specific sequencing of a huge sequence like
that. No, we have to get the matching. That's right. And of course, the way of getting out this gene out of the enormous library that's in human DNA is to, that we actually work with the chicken, is to go to a point in the embryonic cycle where collagen is the major protein being made, and extract the RNA from there, and that RNA is largely encoding collagen. And use that to hybridize with the nucleic acid of the whole organism, and that hybridization picks out the collagen gene, and then recombinant DNA technology takes over. So that's been done, and we, of course, working on these other more minor collagens, and now in this phase we're trying to study how the cell shifts from making one kind of collagen to another, and we have that in tissue culture, and are just trying to understand the means of molecular control which causes it to go one way or the other. For example, one kind of arthritis involves the shift from one kind of collagen to another. The development in the embryo, and it often goes from one to another, so that I think it is a very basic step, and we're just trying to untangle that now. So it's a little way from polymer chemistry, but if you look carefully, you can see some pathway.
In fact, one of my questions to you is how many disciplines are there here, or is it all chemistry, basically?
Yes, well, it's certainly all macromolecules, and I suppose the earliest forms of life must have been much less specific than anything we know now, and perhaps therefore much more polymer-like, with just little islands of order emerging within a much larger high molecular matrix, probably the RNA. In fact, we just had a very interesting lecture here last week by a man, Czech, from the University of Colorado, who has found that RNA, the ribonucleic acid, can actually act as a catalyst like a protein does. And it had always been thought that only proteins would catalyze biological reactions, but the RNA can catalyze its own itself by cutting out pieces of itself and reuniting the strands and so on. So it was probably the RNA that was the first self-producing molecule capable of some self surgery. And Oh, no, I wish if I were young again, I would pull up my boots and continue what we're doing. I think in collagen, I think we'll be in a century or so seen as the primary building material of all higher forms, and that's not a small business.
So, let's see, now, talk about your teaching career a bit. You, when I was here anyway, you were teaching physical chemistry, I guess.
Yeah, I taught physical chemistry.
Polymer chemistry.
Polymer chemistry, and
I even did
inorganic chemistry a couple of times.
Uh-huh. But then, when was the biochemistry department formed as a separate entity?
Well, that was 1967, and I guess I could call myself the founder of that, and I was the first chairman, and I wrote up the chart of the department and got the faculty to approve it.
Did Westheimer come here then, or before?
Westheimer and Bloch came in 54,
uh-huh.
and then Watson came in 54, I think, or 55. So that was the nucleus. Before they came, there was really, I'd say, nothing except what was going on at Edmund Cohn's shop, and he died in 54. Edsel moved over to Biolabs then,
mm-hmm.
and he and I did some things together, as you can see. But in terms of getting a critical size, it took Bloch and Westheimer and Watson, and then we got Nesselson.
Now, you offer degrees which are separate from the chemistry department?
Yes, we are all separate now. Since 67 on. Between 57 and 67, we had a committee on higher degrees in biochemistry,
mm-hmm.
Which is what one does in hybrid fields here. And then in 67, we started our department. And I was chairman also of the building committee, and we were looking hard for money to build a building here, but we failed, and then it wasn't until about 10 years later that when Nesselson was chairman that we got the university to give us a lien on some Mellencamp money that was coming due in 84, I guess, and so we started planning and building, but ultimately got enough gifts to pay it all back.
You gave a beautiful summary, but I wonder if you'd like to reiterate. I'd like to have you reiterate and state what you think your most important scientific contributions are or have been.
Well, I suppose under the rubric of physical properties of macromolecules in solution was sort of the rubric of the earlier phase, and that included the light scattering and a number of other things, but it wasn't focused on a single event and did not have the coherency that for example Flory has in his work. I admire his work most of all. I think
Flory had a little had a little interest in collagen. I remember what.
Yes, he did. That's right.
On,
and
one of the students, Bob Garrett, couldn't talk about anything except rat tail tendon several years.
Uh-huh. Now he had the interesting contribution, which we had missed, that when the collagen is denatured into separate strands and then renatures, you would think it would be a third order reaction, but it's only a first order reaction. And the reason is that the limiting step is the assumption by the individual chain of the proper their configuration and not the frequency with which they come together. And that was a nice, neat point. And Lennep, Paul, was a great chemist.
He tackled this theoretically or just...
No, he did experiments on it, too. He didn't continue it, but it was for a single foray, it was a nice result.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think secondly was the getting the basic configurations, the helical configurations in solution for all three forms, single, double, and triple-stranded molecules. And then thirdly, I think the renaturation, which has had, I think, the greatest impact and usefulness.
And your work, aside from the early light sky, well, I guess the optical rotary dispersion and so on had a strong theoretical.
Yes, that did, and that was helped a lot by a young Englishman, Moffat, who came here and was
came
to
Moffat.
Be an associate professor, but he died of a heart attack on the squash court in 59. Right. Yeah, he was our closest friend at the time.
He was a this field was quantum mechanics.
That's right. So we got him into this.
But he got into the
And did very well.
This suited him well. The theory of
he was very good at that
scattering.
Yes. Yeah,
brilliant man.
Yes,
I admired him.
That is right. Yeah. Yes.
Basically, the bulk of your work was experimental, is that right?
Yes, I think that's true, yes.
And a lot of it was. I remember when I was here, you put in terrible hours.
That's right. I think back to those times, yes.
Do you still?
I still work most of the time, that's true. But it's more sedentary now, and I do a lot of traveling on conferences in my other life. But before we get to that, I guess I should go back and say that I guess Mark and I founded the Journal of Polymer Science back in 47.
Yes.
And that seems to continue. And then in 57, Kendra and I founded the Journal of Molecular Biology, and that continues strongly. And then in 77, I founded the International Security, which has become, I think, the leading quarterly in its field. And I've just stepped down from being chairman of the editorial board last year. So I have these three journals, to my credit, more or less, but always with the help of a lot of other people. And they're flourishing. But I never got around to writing a book. We have about 350 papers from the laboratory here, about two-thirds of them with my name and a third without.
Do you feel that there's a book there, or there's a book needed?
No, I think not. Proper niches are being filled.
Would you settle for the collected papers, though?
Well, no, I think they're a little too scattered to it. It takes a session like this to try to pull them together. No, I think they'll serve their purposes. Time marches on.
Let's talk a little bit about your public service, particularly. Let's see, you were elected to the National Research Council.
Yes, I started those things. Again, I think this is probably Mark's influence. I remember he got me to be, I guess I was secretary of the section of macromolecules of the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. I think that was my first foot in the water, a toe in the water. And I remember we had organized a number of meetings in the 50s.
Does this involve mainly organizing meetings and so on? Or
making sure there's funding and getting the right people to make them interesting.
Okay, but they don't establish research policy or do it?
No. This is just a reporting and internationalization, which was very important in the 50s after the war to get science going again in Europe. I remember meeting in 57 in Prague where I spoke on biological polymers. And I think there, and again in Moscow in 1960, I never enjoyed the public lecturing as much because there was so many people knew nothing about this, and it was I think I filled the opera house in Prague, I remember.
It must be exhilarating.
Yes, yeah, really, it gives you an upper. Yes, so that was very good. In fact, my lecture there in 57, which is amongst my reprints, it sort of summarizes this first phase. And then the the other lecture, the well, in 1960, there's the lecture that did the same thing for the renaturation part.
Do you need
the
publication list?
Yeah.
For that?
Yes, no, 116.
What was that again? The number 116.
16, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So that summary.
This was a summary of the
renaturation.
Renaturation.
Yeah. We saw it at the time. So those were great lectures. I enjoyed them very much. Then, I guess the external part of my life began. Well, I was always infected with the nuclear problem from my early days in the Manhattan Project and all this galaxy that I met at Columbia. So in 57, when I was working hard in the lab, I was elected chairman for the year of the Federation of American Scientists, which was a nuclear interested scientist group. It was in pretty low state then, and
was Kostyakovsky perhaps influential on
his interest in the area was important, but in those days he was still very on the conservative side of things, and I don't think he took this very very kindly then, although he certainly would later.
I gather you're not, we're not perhaps a great admirer of Edward Teller then after that.
No, we had a little, our differences grew, yes, but we get along in a very friendly fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I see you were an Edgar Hawes Smith lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in 1956. Talk headquarters at Edgar Hawes Smith Hall. Actually, it's scattered, but
I see. I see, yes.
That'll catch their attention.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Let me major things. I see you were a member of the President's Science Advisory Committee in 61 through 65.
Yes, but to explain that my going into that line separately, it goes back to this being chairman of the Federation of American Scientists in 57, in which, because I was chairman, I was asked to come to the first Pugwash conference up in Nova Scotia to meet with Russian scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that triggered my going there, because as a result of that, I was invited to Moscow in 58. And then, being one of the few scientists that had gotten to know the Russians, when Eisenhower was preparing for his summit meeting with Khrushchev in 1960, he wanted a committee to advise him on disarmament and so forth, and Jim Killian put me on that committee, and I got clearances and been in the game ever since. So that's how that sort of led to this almost accidental meeting at Pugwash.
And then
once I got there, then Kennedy asked me to be in the Science Advisory Committee, and I've been advising one thing or another down there ever since.
Now, you see, you were also had a two stints as on the Committee for Science, Soviet and American Exchange.
Yes, I got that going and oversaw the first years of that exchange program.
What is the Council on Foreign Relations?
That's a professional group out of New York City on foreign affairs. In fact, I'm chairing a meeting down there on Wednesday. But I suppose most of all, I've kept contact with the Russians. Not that I don't fault them in many ways, but that I really think we have to find ways of living with our differences, and knowing each other better is one way, and finding out how to knowing enough about each other to find means of compromise, living together is an important matter. So I think I was over there in May. I think it was about my 48th trip or so.
Okay.
So that's taken probably a year out of my life right
there. Are you speaking, do you speak Russian? Or
no,
do you
I don't.
Along?
No, I don't. I took it for a while, and I did for a while, but as I say, I'm so poor at languages, I cannot do that.
What's your position on the Strategic Defense Initiative?
Yes, well, I think that is a major technical error in that we should be putting our technical resources elsewhere, even in the military, but it's very divisive.
Mm-hmm.
But the chances of it working are just about zero, I'm afraid.
It seemed to me it was a great pity. It was something that was worthless and expensive, but they could have traded away.
That's right, yes. I hope they still will, but it might take another president to do it.
Okay, well, it's...
Going back even before, back in 52, I guess, because I'd made these rounds in Europe in the 40s and gotten to know a few people, I was invited by the Frenchman to be a pallbearer at the state funeral for Langevin and Perrand, who had both died during the war.
Hmm.
So I went over and participated in this great ceremony, learning only then that they had both joined the Communist Party in the last months of their lives, but I don't think that would have altered it. But then when I came back, and in 54 I applied for a Fulbright Fellowship and learned that I was first on the list but was denied it. It turned out that Mr. McCarthy had held against me my participation in the state funeral. So as a result of that, I was put on the NIH blacklist for serving on committees. And although I got, I got my first top secret clearances in 57 and a lot more after that, it didn't drift into the NIH until about 1975, by which time I had missed being on dozens of study sections and other very demanding work that most people have to do to make sure the grants get distributed.
I see.
So that was amusing aside.
You seem to have done well on grants, nevertheless.
Yes, it has been good. The NIH has been very good to me. We're in our 34th or 35th year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But even that scene is changing a lot now. It's gotten so big.
That leads to another broad question I've been asking people like you. What do you feel about the changes from when you start to now with respect to science funding, science policy? You optimistic or gloomy? Or?
Well, I think on the one hand that we probably do it better than any other nation, and therefore and we have a lot to show for it, and so from that point of view the cup is certainly half full.
You think we're doing it better than the Japanese?
Oh yes, I think so, yes. I mean, the Japanese do many things better, but not basic science.
Are the Japanese doing well in your field of biology?
Well, they're putting a lot of effort into it now, and I think they will.
Molecular biology.
Yeah. But what they lack, and we do so well, is the backing of young people early on with almost unlimited possibilities if they do very well. But the academic university system in Japan, they refuse to pass judgment on each other, so the peer review will never work there.
Hmm.
And consequently, every professor or every assistant professor gets the same amount of research funds. So the only way you can grow out of that very limited system is to join some either industry or general nationwide laboratory, which are quite big. So you can go there, but then you say, well, you get more equipment, and you can't rise very rapidly because the Japanese cultural scene. So I don't think there's any place that matches the U.S. in the opportunities that it offers people in the 30s, and that's much of our strength.
What about the Soviet Union? Do you get much insight into that?
Oh, yes. I still visit my biochemical friends when I go there, and other scientists, too. I got to know most of their great physicists in the early years, and I knew Kapitza extremely well. He was one of my closest personal friends. He died 2 years ago. And I knew others quite well. But I think the story there is much what is widely understood now, that the whole cultural and social and political system does not reward inventiveness, nor does it allow it to flourish and demonstrate its effectiveness. And there's almost no competence in the translation of basic findings into technical accomplishments. They try hard, but they end up having to buy it or steal it from the West. And you see almost nothing in Moscow that is home invented. They have very good in sports, some kinds of music and so forth, and they do organized things. Their cities are in some ways much better organized than ours. But in terms of making science work, it has only really worked well in space and, of course, in the military. But their space program, I think, is on the whole better than ours. But that goes back long before the revolution. They had their own space enthusiasts as we had ours in the early part of the century. And the Russians and the Germans and the Americans were the only ones that had that cultural background of wanting to do big space science, which had to be state supported because it could not be privately supported.
I had a friend who had, Anna Marsh Petrovskis actually, who had made several trips to the Soviet Union. I don't know how many, but he had the feeling that they had sort of a two-tiered system. The military had excellent science and engineering, but the rest of the economy sort of second best. Is that what you're saying, something like that?
I think so, but of course the military gets a lot of special favors and an enormous amount of money. And they have that they're forced to compete with the West in the military sphere, whereas in the commercial sphere, as long as the people don't clamor for too much, they don't feel forced to produce and make the consumer operation efficient and sort of the servant of the people, and so therefore you don't get 20-25 years behind the state of consumer development in the West. But it's a interesting bag. I mean, the people I see there, and pick the biochemistry, I think that for the grace of God, I would be, I think that to be there and just decide that the ties to the homeland are strong and family, and you stay there, then you have to do the best you can, and it's a challenge that none of us would pull off very gracefully, I think. The isotopes, labeled isotopes, or the isotope-labeled biological compounds that are so essential to the kind of work I've been describing, which are made by dozens of little companies here. There's nothing equivalent there, and they have to wait maybe 6 months to get their order in, and then it's apportioned somewhat depending on how good a party member you are. And they have almost no working in the labs at night. It comes from the old from the revolution, where the primary thing to propagate in the new Soviet was not to be exploited, so therefore nobody should work more than 40 hours a week. And even the director of a large laboratory unit has to get three different people to sign off if he wants to go back on the weekend to work, that sort of thing. It's a really different environment.
Interesting. Well, I think you already more or less answered one of my prime questions. I always ask is if you had it to do all over again,
I see.
Would you go the way you went?
Well, I would certainly be a better scientist if I'd stuck to my bench, and I would be a better politician if I'd gone to Washington. But I think people end up doing pretty much what they want when they have the choice, and I've had the choice. The university's been good to me here. It's let me meander around, and they did nothing but encourage me when I set up this Center for Science and International Affairs. So I've been well treated, and I
Has recruiting been easy into this biochemistry and molecular biology research?
Yes, I think it has been compared to the rest of science. It's been quite good. Now it is. I think that in the last 5 years, it's become more difficult. I suppose that probably is a complex cultural thing we don't understand. I think there are a smaller fraction of our brighter people are going into science. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a drain off to better paying professions.
Molecular biology has a really excellent press.
Oh yes, it certainly has a good press. I think the growth of the biotechnology industries is making the future, at least offering a financially attractive future to people who want to go that way. So I think it will sort of develop a fairly substantial and industrial base like chemistry did back in the middle of the century.
Where have most of your graduate students gone in terms of jobs, later careers?
Well, they've almost all gone into academia, but now in the last 5 years they're going into the biochemical industries more. Mm-hmm. The last three have gone into biochemical industries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an exciting phase in its own right now. But so I think coming back to the other side of the half-empty part of science funding, I think that this is a sort of across the board in basic science, that while the National Science Foundation figures show a continuing rise, I think that it isn't as great as it appears. I think the research is getting more expensive. The inflation index for research equipment goes up much faster than for the common consumer products. The willingness to go through the hard hours, long hours that you need in the late 20s and early 30s at very low salaries is taking its toll, I think. And I think that the management of the scientific enterprise is in pretty poor shape. It shouldn't be overmanaged, but well, just to finish off the funding, the fact is that the sort of rule of thumb that had been established in the government was that in addition to the National Science Foundation and the NIH, each of the agencies which use science should contribute to the basic science in some proportion. And defense is the biggest of those, and it has the biggest R&D budget ever now, $60 billion, and yet it's contributing less to basic science than it ever did before. And so that's a very severe imbalance, and I think that again, well, it shouldn't be overmanaged. There's almost no general management in Washington. The science advisor is almost non-existent in policy terms, and the allocation of resources, well, I guess it isn't bad, indeed better than I expected. It's far from optimal. So we could be doing much better, but I can't shed any false tears. It isn't too bad.
Let me touch briefly on your own personal life, your family. See, your son was named Gordon Sutherland.
Yes.
What's he doing now?
He's head of the West Coast branch of the Fuji Bicycle, and he was always a wheel man, and so he's quite happy in San Francisco in the large-scale bicycle business.
Businessman?
Yes.
See. Did he go to college?
No, he went to some to State University, but none of the children have gone to college until recently. Our middle daughter is a senior at Babson, who will graduate in June.
They had no interest in college?
Partly they were extremely dyslexic, much more so than I, and all had terrible reading problems.
Is that recognized early enough that something could be done about it?
We went through an awful lot of experiments, many of which were not successful. And now it is much more straightforward what should be done. But they came at a bad period.
Is this a hereditary thing or something?
It looks like it is, yes.
I've never realized that.
Yes.
So, you had Marcia was the elder. The
oldest, yes. She was just married last month. We were out in San Francisco for that.
And Rebecca is
in Rebecca's in Babson, and Kate is in the travel business out in San Francisco.
Hmm. So they're out of the nest.
We haven't replenished the academia.
Is there any other reminiscences? We have a few minutes, so we can stop now. Are there any? You mentioned a number of distinguished, outstanding people as you went along. I don't know whether there are some others that might have impressed you particularly over the years of your cohorts or students.
I think that I probably mentioned the major ones. I think Walter Stockmayer was a big influence when I was young. He was instructor at Columbia when I was a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, we have done an interview of Stockmayer, although it's not been worked up yet.
Yes, now he was a fine fellow. Mm-hmm. And then here, I think that, I spent my first 20 years here in the chemistry department, and it was certainly a great training ground for sober judgment and so on. And
it's interesting that, looking back at that, among the major professors here, Dodian and Kostiakowski never did a paper together or anything
together.
Neither did Wilson.
Yes.
Although all close personal friends,
yes.
I think.
Yeah, that's right. In other words, it was a collection of little empires, no doubt. And I think everyone sort of had. I think Moffat was a person who moved back and forth, partly because he didn't have many graduate students, being a real theorist.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's interesting. The thing to me is Harvard had some of the character of the European Institute, where each guy had his own empire. And
I think that's it. But it's different from the European scene in that he. You had to make your own show work and be judged by your peers and so on. What's wrong in Europe, particularly Max Planck Institute, seems to me, is that they award the directorship to a person in his early 40s, and he is really a supreme boss, and he has an enormous apparatus, not a research group, but the equivalent of a whole department. And yet there's no one else for him to compete against in his field, and he tends to choose a field then for the rest of his life that is too competitive, and he settles down and does sort of maybe first-class work and a second-class problem, and I think that is a very heavy burden on German science. It could be much better than it is.
Hmm. Well, I think...
Let's leave it at that. If I think of anything striking, I'll give you a call or drop you a note.
Yes, we can always make additions, or as I said earlier, we may have